Cardinal Sean Patrick O'Malley, OFM Capuchin, was born June 29, 1944, in Lakewood, Ohio, and was raised in western Pennsylvania, where he entered a Franciscan seminary. At 21, he was professed into the Order of Friars Minor Capuchin, and at 26, he was ordained a Catholic priest. After earning a master's degree in religious education and a PhD in Spanish and Portuguese literature from the Catholic University of America, he taught at Catholic University and founded Centro Católico Hispano, the Hispanic Catholic Center in Washington, D.C., an organization which provided educational, medical, and legal help to immigrants. Since his ordination to the episcopacy on August 2, 1984, he has served as the Bishop of Dioceses in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, Fall River, Massachusetts, and Palm Beach, Florida. And then he went to a cold place. Pope John Paul II appointed him as Archbishop of Boston in July of 2003. Pope Benedict named him a cardinal in 2006. Let us welcome Cardinal O'Malley.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be here today. As you know, we had a little dusting of snow in Boston, so I took my dog sled to get here. But Wilbur Mills, a longtime speaker in the House and one-time presidential candidate, was involved in a traffic incident here in Washington back in 1974 when I was a young priest working at the Centro Católico. He was stopped by the U.S. Park Police late at night because he was driving without lights. The police discovered that Mills was intoxicated and that his face was injured from a scuffle with Annabella Bastistella, professionally known as Fanny Fox, the Argentine firecracker. In an attempt to escape, they leapt from the car and jumped into the nearby tidal basin. 1 month later, Mills was to be on the ballot in his home state of Arkansas for re-election to the Congress. His challenger used the slogan, "If you like liquor, sex, and thrills, cast your vote for Wilbur Mills." Well, needless to say, Wilbur Mills won handily with 60% of the vote. He had asked for forgiveness from his constituency, explaining to them that his problems were a result of his cavorting with foreigners. For 20 years, I was here in Washington cavorting with foreigners, working at the Spanish Catholic Center, but I didn't find this to be a corrupting influence on my life, but rather a very uplifting experience and indeed a great privilege. Coming from a lace-curtain Irish community in the Midwest, being thrust into the challenges and the sufferings of the immigrant community was truly an eye-opener. Shortly after arriving at the Centro Católico, I was visited by a man who was obviously a campesino from El Salvador, as many of our parishioners were. He sat across me from me at my desk and broke down and began to weep bitterly. He was so overcome with grief that he couldn't even speak. He simply handed me a letter that was from his wife back in El Salvador, who remonstrated him for having abandoned her and their six children to penury and starvation. When the man was able to compose himself, he explained to me that he had come to Washington, like so many, because with the wars raging in his country, it was impossible to sustain his family by farming. So a coyote, a smuggler, brought him to Washington, where he shared a room with several other men in similar circumstances. He washed dishes in two restaurants, or as my parishioners used to say, they were grabando discos, recording records, one at lunchtime and another restaurant at dinner time. He told me that he ate the leftover food on the dirty plates so as not to spend money. He walked to work so as to save on transportation, so that he could send all of his money back to his family. Each week he would take all the money that he was able to earn and put it in an envelope and send it back to his wife and children. But 6 months had passed and she had not received a single letter from him and was accusing him of abandoning her and the children. I asked him if he sent check or money order. He said, "Oh no, Padre, I send cash. Each week I put the money into an envelope with the amount of stamps that I was told, and I drop it in that blue mailbox on the corner." I looked out of my window and I could see the blue mailbox. The problem was it was not a mailbox at all, but a fancy trash bin. That encounter certainly brought home to me how difficult it is to be an immigrant, to be a stranger in a strange land, and to experience countless humiliations and deprivations as one struggles to make enough money to feed one's children. Nor was it just the undocumented workers who were suffering in their new surroundings. Another very important demographic that we served at the Spanish Catholic Center were the many domestic workers who would come to Washington to work as servants for diplomats and international employees of the embassies, Inter-American Development Bank, World Bank, Inter-American Defense Board, the Organization of American States, and the many other international bodies that are entitled to grant diplomatic visas for household workers. In many cases, it was just an exercise in human trafficking. Many women were exploited economically and sexually. Often their passports were held by their employers to keep them from leaving. Whenever I would confront any of these diplomats, they would always say to me, "Padre, somos muy católicos, y la tratamos como un miembro de nuestra familia. We are very Catholic, and we treat her like a member of our family." To which I would always reply, "I'm so glad I'm not a member of your family." Then, of course, they would tell me what they thought about my ancestors and that I was a communist. Those were very interesting days to be a Catholic and to be in Washington, D.C. There was a very active Catholic worker group here. Nellie Gray was organizing the March for Life. There were many organizations with outreach to Latin America. The peace movement was flourishing. And there was a strong alliance with Reverend Martin Luther King's struggle for racial justice and great interest in the social gospel of the church. It seems like a long time ago. I'm very happy to be part of this conference here today. First of all, it gives me the opportunity as a bishop to thank all of you who are involved in promoting the social gospel of the church in our day. I am very pleased that Bishop Blair and others in the conference are working so diligently to bring together those who are involved in the pro-life movement and in the social justice ministry of the church. Both of these important expressions of our Catholic faith are a constituent part of evangelization. The gospel of life is so basic to the social teaching of the church. As Pope Benedict says it so well, openness to life is at the center of true development. When a society moves towards the denial or suppression of life, it ends up no longer finding the necessary motivation and energy to strive for man's true good. If personal and social sensitivity towards the acceptance of new life is lost, then other forms of acceptance that are valuable for society also wither away. The acceptance of life strengthens moral fiber and makes people capable of mutual help. By cultivating openness to life, wealthy people can better understand the needs of the poor. They can avoid huge economic and intellectual resources to satisfy the selfish desires of their own citizens, and instead they can promote virtuous action with a perspective that is morally sound and marked by solidarity, respecting the fundamental right to life of every person and every individual. When I was in our seminary, the provincial, Father Victor, wrote a letter to Rome in which he said that our mission in Puerto Rico was flourishing and that we were prepared to take on a second mission. He said he wanted the most difficult mission in the world. The response was lightning quick, saying that we should open a mission in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. The guardian at Capuchin College, Father Herman Schmidt, was named the first bishop, and a group of friars were sent. Eventually, three of my classmates went. It was reported back to us from the first group of friars that when they landed in the highlands in a small plane, the natives, who had never seen Europeans or an airplane, were very curious, and they asked through a translator if the plane was a male or a female. They said if it was a female, they wanted an egg. Many years later, as a young friar, I ordained a young friar working in Papua New Guinea who came to see me on his home visit. He had glorious pictures of smiling natives with bones in their noses, feathers in their hair, and little else in the way of clothing. He announced very proudly, "This is my parish council." I was particularly intrigued because one of my own pastors in Massachusetts had just told me that his parishioners were not ready for a parish council. But I often thought that if Father Victor wrote that letter today asking for the most difficult mission in the world, we may not have been sent to Papua New Guinea, but rather to the United States. In the same vein, at the World Youth Day in Cologne, Pope Benedict, addressing the bishops of Germany at the seminary, referred to his native country, Germany, as a mission land. This is true for so many places in the Western world where secularism and dechristianization are gaining ground. We need to find new ways of bringing the gospel to the contemporary world, of proclaiming Christ anew, and of implanting the faith. As Pope Benedict said, we're not here just for the existing flock. We must be a missionary church. Our task is to turn our parishioners who are consumers into disciples and disciple makers. We need to prepare men and women who witness to the faith and not send people into the witness protection program. As the U.S. bishops wrote in Go Make Disciples, every Catholic can be a minister of welcome, reconciliation, and understanding to those who have stopped practicing the faith. In the new millennium, business as usual is not enough. We must be a team of missionaries, moving from a maintenance mode to a missionary one. We must ask ourselves, what does it mean to live in a culture of unbelief? A culture which does not even know that it does not believe because it still lives on the residue of a Christian civilization. As Hauerhaus has expressed it so well, the church exists today as resident aliens, an adventurous colony in a society of unbelief. As a society of unbelief, Western culture is devoid of the sense of journey, of adventure, because it lacks belief in much more than the cultivation of an ever-shrinking horizon of self-preservation and self-expression. To be a faithful disciple of Jesus Christ in the Catholic Church is much more than a head trip. It's a way of life together. The whole person is engaged in the process. Education for this journey must therefore be experiential, personal, engaging, and life-giving. We learn discipleship the way we learn a language, by being part of a community that speaks that language. Our young Catholics must be mentored in the faith by others, either peers or older Catholics who are walking the walk. The mission of the Church is about making disciples, helping people respond to the call to holiness by being part of a faith-filled, worshiping community, struggling to be faithful to the gospel. Discipleship is about living with Christ in a faith community, striving to model our lives on his teaching and example, and then pass on the faith and build a civilization of love based on justice and solidarity. This is not something new in the history of the Church. We've been doing it for 2,000 years. One of the first attempts is documented in a stunning book that comes to us from the first century. It's called the Didache, which means the training. It was the first training manual for initiating people into the life of the Church. It was memorized by the mentors or teachers who used it as a lesson plan, catechism, liturgical worship aid, and a primer for faithful discipleship. The Didache described the step-by-step transformation by which converts were to be prepared for a full active participation in the life of the Church. As Melorick says in his commentary on this remarkable document, any community that cannot artfully and effectively pass on its cherished way of life as a program for divine wisdom and graced existence cannot long endure. Any way of life that cannot be clearly specified, exhibited, and differentiated from the alternative modes operative within the surrounding culture is doomed to growing insignificance and gradual assimilation. The Didache shows us that for the Church, teaching the faith is always a process of mentoring. Then as now, we're not transmitting our own theories or notions, but speaking and hopefully witnessing the Word of God. And the Word of life is never to be received as mere information. The mentor was expected to illustrate, inquire, question, listen, and challenge his candidate in such ways that not only the words, but the deeper meaning of the way of life were being suitably assimilated at every step. The Didache also tries to prepare its novices for the rejection by their friends, relatives, and even by the dominant culture, which is hostile to the gospel teachings. Another early writing that has always fascinated me is the letter to Dionietos, where the author is describing to his friend what Christians are like. He says, well, they live in the same neighborhoods, they speak the same language, dress like everybody else, but they don't kill their babies, and they respect the marriage bond. Very quaint indeed. It's a little scary to think that Dionietos could have written this letter last week. In today's world, Catholic education must be Didache, training in a way of life which is increasingly alien in the secular world, where our concerns about unborn children or the sacredness of marriage make us appear quaint or even nettlesome. We need mentors, parents, grandparents, godparents, teachers, neighbors who are ready to pass on the faith. As a young priest, I was privileged to be present at the Puebla Conference in Mexico. It was John Paul II's very first trip after being elected pope. As the pope's plane landed in Mexico City, all the church bells in the country rang out with joy. The successor of St. Peter was in our midst. The crowd extended along the highway from Mexico City to Puebla. People had come the day before and slept on the highway. It reminded me of the Acts of the Apostles, where Luke describes how the people put the sick by the side of the road so that Peter's shadow would touch them. The crowd that comprised of millions of Mexicans extended over 60 miles. The government had tried to discourage people from going. The word was, watch the Pope on television. Nobody paid attention to that plea. But afterwards, the government officials were forced to report that there were no troublesome incidents due to the crowds as they had feared. Indeed, the crime rate fell to an all-time low while the Pope was in the country. The government speculated that even the burglars and the pickpockets went for the Pope's blessing. When the Holy Father arrived in Puebla, he got out of his open car, walked across the soccer field to a makeshift altar, and celebrated the opening Mass for the Puebla conference. And I shall never forget his homily. He challenged us to be teachers of the faith, to teach the truth about Christ, the truth about the church, the truth about the human person. The same message is as crucial to us today. The content of our teaching must embrace all these truths. The truth about Christ, the Son of God, true God and true man, our crucified Redeemer, our risen Lord, who has promised to be with us always and who established his church on the rock of Peter. The truth about the church, founded by Jesus on the apostles, guided by the Holy Spirit, gathering God's people around the altar, calling us to discipleship, conversion, and ministry. A church teaching with authority, witnessing to the presence of the risen Lord, and serving Christ, especially in the poor and the downtrodden. The truth about the human person, that each one is an irreplaceable mystery made in God's image and likeness, called to an eternal destiny. The Church's teachings on human rights, the gospel of life, sexual morality, and social justice are all corollaries of this great truth about our origins and our destiny. The Church's medical ethics, service to the poor, sick, and infirm, the works of mercy and social services, the promotion of a more just society, are all interconnected and crucial to our task of passing on the faith and building a civilization of love. The amazing thing is that historically the church was persecuted mostly for the truths that we taught about Christ and the church. The controversies of Arianism, transubstantiation, papal infallibility. But today, the attacks are directed at the church are for our teachings concerning the dignity of the human person, the sacredness of life, the importance of marriage, and all the prerogatives that flow from being made in the image and likeness of God, placed on this earth to build a civilization of love. The Church's commitment to teach the social gospel and promote human development flows from our duty to proclaim the truth about the human person. In his encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, Pope Benedict addresses the problems of global development and progress toward the common good, arguing that both love and truth are essential elements of an effective response. Justice is inseparable from charity. On the one hand, charity demands justice, recognition and respect for the legitimate rights of individuals and peoples. On the other hand, charity transcends justice and completes it with the logic of giving and forgiving. The earthly city is promoted not merely by relationships of rights and duties, but to an ever greater and more fundamental extent by relationships of gratuitousness, mercy, and communion. Charity always manifests God's love in human relationships as well. It gives theological and salvific value to all commitment for justice in the world. Our striving for the common good in society is simply a logical corollary of our love of neighbor. Unjust structures and oppressive political and economic systems result when ethics and virtue are banished from the public square as irrelevant to building a just and humane society. As Pope Benedict has stated, The sharing of goods and resources from which authentic development proceeds is not guaranteed by merely technical progress in relationships of utility, but by the potential of love that overcomes evil with good, opening up the path towards reciprocity of consciences and liberties. When John Paul II visited Madrid in 2003, addressing 1 million young people, he told them, "Respond to the blind violence and inhuman hatred with the fascinating power of love." We all know that evil has its fascination and attraction, but too often we lose sight of the fact that love and goodness also have a power to attract, and that virtue is winsome. Passing on the faith means helping people to have a real relationship with Christ that will equip them to lead a good life, a moral life, a just life. Thus, part of our job in passing on the faith is to help our people become virtuous. Plato thought that virtue was knowledge. Here at the Holocaust Museum, they used to have a wonderful letter on the wall from Chaim Ginot, a concentration camp survivor, who reminds us how doctors, nurses, scientists, and soldiers were all part of the Holocaust machinery, showing that knowledge is not virtue, and that often science and technology have been put at the service of evil. Peter Kreft has said that in our contemporary society, we have reduced all virtue to one, being nice. Kreft laments that for the first time in history, moral relativism and subjectivism are not the aberration of rebels, but the reigning orthodoxy of the intellectual establishment. So often university academes and those in the media reject any belief in a universal or objective morality. And in our public schools, values clarification based on a moral ping-pong of preferences and discussion serves us values that are often more about feelings and calculations than about truths or principles. We need to equip our people for a life of discipleship. They need to know the truths of our faith, and they need to know how to live those truths. The way most of us become real Christians is by looking over someone else's shoulder, emulating some admired older member of our family or parish, saying yes and taking up a way of life that was made real and accessible to the witness of someone else. We need mentors, just as the Didache called for mentors to accompany the neophytes of the early church. We live in a world obsessed by celebrities. Celebrities have replaced heroes and heroines for our young people. Oftentimes, these celebrities, for all their good looks, talents in singing, acting, or sports, lead lives that are superficial, self-absorbed, and chaotic. The church has always held up for us the lives of the saints. They provide examples of the universal call to holiness. The saints model for us the struggle to overcome human weakness and sinfulness and embrace God's will in our lives. In the life of Dorothy Day, we read how, as a child, she experienced a terrible earthquake in her town in California. People were forced to live in tents for weeks because of the destruction of property and the aftershocks that followed the earthquake. What fascinated young Dorothy was to see how neighbors who formerly didn't even know each other's names suddenly began to talk to each other. They were even sharing their food and water, taking care of the children and the elderly, and forming a true community. But soon enough, things got back to normal, and the old indifference and individualism returned to their neighborhood. Dorothy Day's whole life was a quest to recapture that sense of community she had experienced after the earthquake. That quest led her into the Communist Party and eventually into the Catholic Church. In 1932, already a Catholic, Dorothy Day came to Washington, D.C. as a journalist to cover a hunger march for the unemployed. During that time, she felt strongly her separation from her previous friends who were protesting under the socialist banner. Dorothy Day went to the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception here in Washington on December the 8th and spent the whole morning in prayer, asking God to help her find a way to integrate her newly found Catholic faith with her concern for the poor. When she returned to New York, Peter Morin was waiting for her, and that friendship transformed her life. As a young seminarian here in Washington, I met Dorothy Day on many occasions. However, I never had the opportunity to meet Peter Morin. I was involved with a Catholic worker here, and his writings inspired me as a seminarian. He was an eccentric French peasant who had been a lay brother. He was a man in love with Christ and the social message of the gospel. He used to go every day to give Dorothy Day her education, talking to her for hours about a Catholic outline of history, the saints, the teachings of the popes, and what he called his personalist communitarian philosophy. Peter directed Dorothy Day's readings and formed her spiritually. His philosophy was not to denounce, but announce. Dorothy once said, "He made you feel that you had a great and generous heart with which to love God. He made you feel a sense of mission." Peter Morin used to say, "Modern society calls the beggar a bum and a panhandler and gives him the bum's rush." But the Greeks used to say that people in need are ambassadors of the gods. One of Peter's famous writings is called Easy Essays and contains the following advice. The world would be better off if people tried to become better, and people would become better if they stopped trying to be better off. For everyone tries to become better off, nobody is better off. And when everyone tries to become better, everyone is better off. Everyone would be rich if nobody tried to become richer, and nobody would be poor if everybody tried to be the poorest. And everybody would be what he ought to be if everybody tried to be what he wants the other fellow to be. I'm sure that Peter Morin would have appreciated the story about Cardinal Spellman, who one day was sitting in his office when the intercom rang. It was the new receptionist in the lobby of the Chancery who said in a whisper, "Your Eminence, there's a man in the lobby who says he's Jesus Christ. What should I do?" The cardinal replied, "Look busy." The cardinal was right, of course, because that homeless, office-med, schizophrenic man is Jesus Christ in a distressing disguise, as Mother Teresa used to say. It's important for our people to hear about the saints and contemporary heroes like Dorothy Day, who, having had an abortion and another child out of wedlock, became one of the most outstanding persons in the history of our church in the last century. Our young people need to see the ideals of the gospel lived in our lives. One of the worst results of the current scandal in the church can be a cynicism about the call to holiness in the church. We run the risk of being overwhelmed by the bad example of priests and bishops and need to remind people that there have always been saints and sinners in the church. The church's task is to call everyone to conversion. We have our successes and our failures. The saints are the success stories our people need to know. It helps them to see that we are struggling on the same path to holiness. We must also break the bad habit of presenting the church in such a way that people are deceived into thinking that they can be Christians and remain strangers. The privatization of religion in today's climate of New Age individualism is poisonous to the church's message of community and of connectedness in the body of Christ. Too many so-called spiritual people could say, "My karma ran over my dogma." As a seminarian, I read an interview with Flannery O'Connor about growing up Catholic in the South. The famous author related how as a child she had a playmate, a little Baptist girl, who was her closest friend. She had invited her friend to Mass one day. The little girl got permission from her mom and went with Flannery to church. Flannery couldn't wait to hear her friend's reaction. As soon as Mass was over, she said, "Well, what did you think? What did you think?" Her little girlfriend said, "Wow, you Catholics really got something there. The music was so bad. The preaching was so boring. The priest was mumbling in a language nobody could understand. And all those people were there." In a culture addicted to entertainment, our Catholics today often find Sunday Mass a rather unsatisfying experience, like Flannery O'Connor's Baptist girlfriend. Our challenge is to be teachers of prayer, to help our Catholics experience prayer so that when they gather for the Sunday Eucharist, they can have a notion of why they are there and how to pray. There can be no Catholic life, no holiness, no discipleship, no social justice without prayer. Every Catholic school, every religious education program, every service project must have a prayer component that will help our Catholics to be part of a worshiping community. It is gathered around the altar that we recognize Christ in the breaking of the bread, and where by partaking of the Eucharist we become one with Christ and with one another. In the Sunday Eucharist, we discover our own identity, our connectedness with the Lord and each other, and the radical love that makes a gift of self. And in the Eucharist, we find the strength and motivation for our mission, including the works of mercy and the social gospel. Paul VI in Evangelii Nuntiandi states that there are profound links between evangelization and human advancement, and that there is an unceasing interplay of the gospel and of one's concrete life, both personal and social. Both Paul VI and Benedict XVI speak of development and social justice as a vocation that is derived from the transcendent call, and affirm that there is no true humanism but that which is open to the absolute and is conscious of a vocation which gives human life its true meaning. Pope Benedict writes, "If development were concerned with merely technical aspects of human life and not with the meaning of man's pilgrimage through history in company with his fellow human beings, nor with identifying the goal of that journey, then the Church would not be entitled to speak on development, human advancement, and the social gospel." Our hope is that this conference will help us to discover more deeply the radical sense of our vocation to live the social gospel, to put others first, and seek the last place to be close to Jesus, who came to serve and not to be served. Love and justice must motivate us to work for a transformation of our own heart so that we can transform the world around us. Among the first Christians, their sense of the presence of the risen Lord was so strong that they gladly shared their possessions so that no one would be in want. They initiated the diaconate to overcome ethnic divisions. They took care of widows and orphans and rejected the Roman practice of abortion and infanticide. And Paul, in his letter to Philemon, states that Onesimus is a slave no longer, but rather a brother. Living out the gospel always calls people to announce the kingdom and to live the values of the kingdom here and now, and in doing that, to renew society by bringing the light of God's love and truth into the world. This vocation is never easy. It always demands sacrifice and making a gift of oneself. The Japanese have a wonderful parable about a man who lives in a beautiful mansion on the top of a mountain, and each day would go out for a walk and look at the sea below. And one day as he was out walking, he saw on the horizon a huge tsunami that was rushing toward the shore. And then he saw a group of his neighbors down on the beach having a picnic. And he wanted to warn them, so he began to wave his arms and shout, but they were too far away. They couldn't see him or hear him. So you know what that man did? Went into his beautiful home and he set it on fire. And his neighbors down on the beach, when they saw the smoke and the flames, some of them said, "Let's climb the mountain and help our neighbor to save his home." And the others said, "Oh, that mountain is so steep and we're having so much fun. You go." Well, the ones who climbed the mountain to help their neighbor were saved, and those who stayed on the beach having fun perished. Sometimes when we perform a work of mercy or make some extraordinary effort for a more just society, we think that we're doing God a favor. Actually, we're doing ourselves a favor. We're climbing a mountain that will bring us home to God. God bless you.